Tamari, welcome to First Up to a Tahiki Te Oho Wharapa, Wednesday, the 17th of April. Kornei Tharare Aho. Coming up, Donald Trump couldn't stay awake during jury selection, but Bevan Hurley could, and he updates us from New York. We're going to talk to Honiana Love from Ngā Taonga Sound and Vision, who says they're keen to house News Hub's video archive. Pam Corkery is with us to tell us more details of the Sydney stabbings. And Tramp Champ Dylan Schmidt is getting ready for his third Olympics.
It's definitely tough. I'm one of the older athletes now, so there's a lot of young guns coming through that are pretty incredible athletes. So the routines are big, the scores are big. So basically, you just got to go big or go home. Honestly, I'm just looking forward to an Olympics without a mask.
Good morning. Welcome to First Up to a Tahiki Te Oho on RNZ National. My name's Nathan Rarere and I've got an interesting program to bring you today. We're going to kick things off in New York City. So former President Donald Trump's in court right now for jury selection in his hush money trial. Bevan Hurley is there. He's standing somewhere nearby and is with us. Kia ora, Bevan. How are you?
Kia ora, Nathan. Doing well, thank you.
Now tell me, what is the latest out of the court that you know of?
So just a few minutes ago, we had the first batch of 18 potential jurors make it through the initial phase of jury selection vetting. So they had been asked that seven-page questionnaire that we discussed a couple of weeks ago, setting out their media habits and whether or not they were, you know, a Proud Boy or an Antifa member. So they are now being quizzed by both sets of lawyers. The prosecutors and defence will have 30 minutes to ask a series of questions to each individual juror separately. Now, this process could go on for as long as 2 weeks. It can be very long and tedious, and Trump has appeared to indeed lose interest and nod off on a couple of occasions. He was caught sort of lolling back in his chair yesterday and looking like he'd sort of drifted off to sleep, which is, you know, quite funny given his attacks on Sleepy Joe Biden. He did perk up this morning when one prospective juror said that he'd read The Art of the Deal, you know, that sort of
I guess
you could say reputation making book from the 80s, you know, the one. We've sort of seen a lot of fire and brimstone from Trump as he's been going in and out of court, calling Judge Juan Merchana a Trump hating judge and saying the whole thing is a scam. But he's really tried to turn on the charm a little bit in court. He knows that these 12 jurors, when they're eventually selected, are going to have, you know, his future sort of prospects of freedom and in their hands. So, you know, it's a bit of a tale of two Trumps at the moment, Nathan.
I bet it is. We'll keep abreast of that one. Now, the world obviously awaiting Israel's response to Iran's weekend attack. What's the feeling amongst the US military?
So sources within the Biden administration have been telling CNN that they expect that the Israeli military response will be limited in scope after that quite major attack by Iran over the weekend. There is US intelligence to suggest that Israel is weighing a narrow and limited strike inside Iran. I guess it's a bit like a face-saving operation for the Israelis, but they don't feel like they are on the brink of sort of, you know, trying to set off a broader scale confrontation than that. Of course, Israel has not always been very forthcoming with information in the past. For example, they did not give the US hardly any warning when they launched that attack in Syria last week that killed senior members of the Iranian sort of armed forces, which led to the missiles being launched at the weekend. So, you know, we can only hope for further de-escalation. Biden spoke to Bibi Netanyahu at the weekend and he said, "You got to win, take the win," you know, after they managed to shoot down all those rockets. So, fingers crossed.
Hey, Bevan, let's talk chicken. Let's talk fried chicken. This is interesting. There are virtual staff in the Philippines somehow serving at a New York City fried chicken joint. How does this work?
So San San Chicken in Long Island City in Queens has employed roughly a dozen virtual assistants based in the Philippines who greet the customers, basically talk through the menu options via a screen, and then, you know, sort of give them a few maybe pointers about what they might be hoping to eat. And so this virtual restaurant staff has really raised some questions about whether or not these guys are being exploited. For example, they're on $3 an hour, where the minimum wage here is $16 an hour, and they're working on a 12-hour time difference, so they're explaining their New York lunch menu when they're probably should be nodding off to sleep. But the guy who set this up, he had a restaurant that went bust during the pandemic, and he said that the experience had reinforced the ideas that restaurants have been squeezed by high rents and inflation, and that a virtual assistant model could help maximize retail spaces and improve store efficiency.
Yeah, that's a good way to say I'm going to pay my staff less. Thank you very much, Bevan Hurley, with us there from New York City. And it's 11 past five right now. We'll go to Australia, and in Brisbane, it's Pam Corkery. Kia ora, Pam. What a week.
So difficult and depressing. Go on.
Why don't we start with the stabbing at the church in Sydney? I mean, do we police say act of terror? What do we actually know anything about the 16-year-old perpetrator?
Well, for starters, not his name, but we do know that he was found in possession of, this is his background, a flick knife at a train station late last year and having a knife at school in 2020. But where the motive comes in, it's reported in The Guardian this morning saying that he said if he, the victim of the attack, Bishop Emmanuel, didn't get himself involved in my religion, I wouldn't have come here. So that pretty well, backs up the fact that it's a motivated terrorist attack, religiously motivated.
Okay, so
I don't know what that means. I'm just telling it like I've been told.
If he didn't get involved in my religion, I wouldn't have come here. That's what he said about this.
Yeah, isn't it sad?
Oh, okay, all right. So there's that as well. And then, of course, we talked Monday about the victims of the Bondi Junction Mall attack. But one of the heroes who is not a straightaway Aussie, but they would like him to be, Pam.
Oh, and I believe, this is Albanese has said, you can stay here permanently. And I believe most Australians would be down with that. You know, he took on the knife-wielding guy, and, there's footage showing Damien Gibbeau stopping the murderer from going to the next level of the shopping centre. He was holding a really heavy bollard for a long time. I mean, I watched it on the telly. He's being lauded for giving shoppers more time to escape. It could have meant saving lives. I think he was a hero. And, I still remember the Rainbow Warrior, so I'm not that keen on French, but I have to give it to him.
There we go.
Yeah.
Let's move to this criminal case against Bruce Lehrman, who should have taken the win when he had it. The criminal case against Bruce Lehrman was dropped because his victim, Brittany Higgins, couldn't face court, but he sued Network 10 for defamation. It didn't work out very well, did it? Did it, Pam?
Well, he had to pay for his coke habit, obviously. Lehrman is staring down the barrel of paying legal bills said to be between 5 and 10 mil from this defamation not being upheld. And he hasn't got money. He keeps spending it. Now, Australia's federal court has found on the balance of probabilities, Bruce Lehrman raped Brittany Higgins at Parliament House in 2019. Justice Michael Lee found the pair had sex in the senator's office, that Higgins didn't consent, and that Lehrman was indifferent to whether she had consented. Lee has been delivering his judgment in the defamation case against Network 10 and a journalist there, Lisa Wilkinson, and he said, Mr. Lehrman raped Ms. Higgins. I hasten to stress this is a finding on the balance of probabilities. Mind you, this is a civil standard of proof, so it won't see Lehrman go to prison, unless it's taken up in a criminal court. But it did. He was running from media yesterday and was hiding in a gas station toilet. So we all know things have gone tits up when that happens.
Yeah, when you end up there, I like this. Having escaped the lion's den, Mr. Lehrman made the mistake of coming back for his hat.
Brilliant quote.
That is
from
a great
judge.
Quote, isn't it?
Yes.
Let's have a look
yes.
at someone who's back, though. Molly the Magpie is back with her doggy pal, Piggy. There's
no,
a nice one.
You don't have to tell me. This is so good. I love Molly. And I have to thank Katrina Batten for putting me on to Molly. It made me really happy this week. We needed it.
Yeah.
So wildlife authorities had taken Molly the magpie from the couple who nursed Molly when she fell out of the nest a couple of years back. Turns out humans can't keep an animal or fowl that's classed as wildlife. The agency held Molly for 6 weeks after the Gold Coast couple were pressured to surrender him, but the internet fans, of which there are 2 million, won the day as Molly and Peggy's separation reached international news sites, and also, as we've talked about, the Queensland premiere popped in. The parents, the human couple, Wells and Reese, announced that Molly was home again on Monday, but they were really quiet, just still photos. But yesterday, last night, party time. Molly's all over it. She's just driving that dog mad again. And I am that's the only happy thing I can say from the last 5 days, you know, obviously. Yeah. It's just been grim as quiet, still quiet, you know?
Yeah, it's always nice when a little bit of ray of sunshine shines through the murk. Thank you very much, Pam Corkery, who was with us there from Brisbane. It is 16 minutes past five. We go to the Middle East now. Alex Baird joins us from Doha. Morena, Alex.
Morena, Nathan.
Hey, we heard earlier from Bevan in New York City about what the US military think about how Israel might respond to the Iranian attack. You are closer to where it's all happening. What have you heard?
Yeah, so this is the big question for everyone worldwide, including in the region. So the most we have heard from the Israelis is the head of the Israeli military saying that the country will respond to the weekend attack. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has summoned his war cabinet for the third time in 3 days to try and work out what kind of response there will be. But there have been no details, provided they're playing their cards very, very close to their chests. But they have said that the launch of so many missiles, this is a quote, cruise missiles and drones into Israeli territory will be met with a response. So the question therefore is, what kind of attack will this take? Will this be an attack directly on Iranian soil, or will this be an attack on an Iranian proxy? Or will this be an attack again on a consulate, for instance, like we had in Damascus? The problem with an attack on Iranian soil is that the regime in Tehran has promised that if there is an attack, there will be an even stronger counterattack from them. So we have spoken for months about the concerns that the conflict in Gaza may spiral out into the wider region. And I think what you're staring down right now is the biggest possibility that that could happen. And if Israel feels like it has support, especially from the United States, and if Israel goes forward and carries out an attack on Iranian soil, I think you could well be staring down the barrel of a conflict, which is just not that far from where I'm doing across from. So it's very concerning if it does go that way.
I bet it is. Let's go to Gaza there, because of course we can't forget that. There's been more mass graves discovered at Al-Shifa Hospital there, according to reports.
Yeah, so this is awful stuff. So Israeli troops withdrew from Al-Shifa Hospital, which was the largest operational hospital, keyword was, in the Gaza Strip, and had been under siege for many weeks by Israeli forces and completely rendered unusable now. Now, families and people from the hospital have been moving into that complex now that Israeli forces have withdrawn, and have been finding time and time again mass graves. And the most recent, on Monday, 15 bodies recovered from a mass grave around the Al-Shifa Hospital complex. People are still digging, so who knows? There may be more to dig up. You've got to remember when people moved in after Israeli troops withdrew, there were just bodies out in the open as well. So hundreds have already been recovered from areas around the hospital since the siege ended on April 1st. I wouldn't advise anyone go to look this footage up. It's really sobering stuff. Mm. But I think any which way you look at it, it's pretty awful. Hundreds of bodies and more expected to come.
We also hear all around the world this heavy rain events, flooding, starting to happen more and more and more. I'd always think of desert regions as being, immune to that. But Oman has seen a number of deaths after some flooding there.
Yeah, so Oman's had at least 18 people die when heavy rains and flash flooding swept through both them and the UAE. That included, sadly, 9 school children when they were being driven and their vehicle was washed away in an area called Samad Ashan on Sunday. There are 2 missing people still, and the storm has actually just passed over Qatar. So we were seeing images earlier in the day of some pretty awful weather in the south of the country. Now, it's interesting. You were saying, you know, we're talking more and more about these sorts of events. I first moved to Qatar in 2019. And in those first 2 years, there was rain once. And the last 12 months, we've had rain half a dozen times. And the interesting thing is here that when it rains, it really rains. It's heavy. The streets aren't designed for it. So this is why you get this flooding, because we're not used to rain here. The sewage systems aren't like New Zealand, which also struggle at times. But here they really struggle. You'll get leaks in homes. But you have immense flash flooding because the water essentially has nowhere to go and there's been no planning to try and get it out of the streets and into the sea. So the more this is happening, the more of a wake-up call it is for the region. But at the same time, we're moving into summer. So bizarrely, just a few days ago, we were heading into the high 30s and now we're in the low 20s with flash flooding happening throughout the region. I would say in the 2 to 3 weeks, we'll be in the 40-degree range again. So a very unusual time for this region, Ari, the weather.
Yeah, Alex, thank you so much for your time. That is Alex Beard in Doha. 21 past 5, Nathan Rarere here at First Up on RNZ National Shows. Coming up, we've got the wonderful World of Trade Me. Also, too, Dylan Schmidt, trampoline champ, on his way to another Olympics. Well, this week on Trade Me, a giant wooden sculpture of a hand. It's got a real Adams Family vibe to it. Also, a legit supercar. But first, producer Jeremy Parkinson talks to Trade Me's Jess Malcolm about a property in Auckland's leafiest of leafy suburbs.
So this historic Remuera mansion is known as Barrow Shan. It was originally built in 1916. It got a major facelift in the 30s and then went through a big restoration project, which was completed in 2022. It's got lovely historical features and old world charm while also having every modern touch. It's got a wine cellar, a library, space for a gym, a chef's kitchen along with a butler's pantry, formal living and dining rooms, and a large family room with expansive views stretching out over the harbour and city. Apparently, the house has also been acoustically engineered for quiet living and privacy. Outside, there are mature trees, sprawling lawns, tranquil courtyards, and of course, a sparkling pool. So this 5-bedroom home goes up for auction on May 18, and it has a homes estimate of around $28 million.
Holy smoke. And that, I mean, the view itself is about $16 million of that. Honestly, that is the most spectacular view of Auckland. And I think if, like, Auckland had a king, or queen, that's pretty much where they'd live. I'm pretty sure of that. But if you wanted to lower the tone a wee bit, what you'd do is you'd spend a couple of grand on our next auction, which is the Adams Family tribute sculpture. It is thing from the Adams Family, carved out of a giant, solid, single piece of oak. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, so a spooky listing this week. So this is a giant wooden ham sculpture straight out of the Adams Family. It looks just like Thing, the pet hand in the TV series and movies, and it's essentially a giant hand crafted out of a tree. So it's solid oak, it weighs about 2,000 kilograms, it's about 3 metres tall. It's got quite large kind of creepy fingernails and knobbly wooden fingers, and the top of the hand, where the wrist would be, hasn't been carved, so it's still got the natural bark on the outside. So why would anyone want this? The reasons provided by the seller include it's a great conversation starter, it adds a touch of whimsy to any space, and it's a must-have for collectors of oddities. But I reckon the best use of this would be in the front garden during Halloween, and the local neighbourhood kids would absolutely love it.
Yeah, you'd want to keep it outside all year round and then sort of do it up for Halloween, because you wouldn't be able to bring it in and out of the shed. It's pretty big.
Yeah, that's right. Fairy lights or something like that. So shipping could be a bit of a challenge, but the seller has their own crane truck and is happy to negotiate on delivery. So if you want to snatch this up, you will need to hand over a fair bit of cash. It's currently bidding at about $2,000. The auction closes on Saturday morning.
Amazing. Probably the coolest car you've ever featured on the spot is up for grabs this week. For around $800,000, you can get yourself a 2005 Ford GT. It is the most wicked looking car.
Yeah, so this is a stunning example of the iconic 2005 Ford GT. It's in centennial white with blue racing stripes. And it's only got 5,000 kilometres on the clock, so it's practically brand new. And this car is more than just a vehicle. It's a modern interpretation of a classic legend. And you'd hope so, because the asking price is $800,000, as you said, Jeremy, and it's being marketed by Aston Martin Auckland. So the 2005 Ford GT was a modern-day homage to the legendary Ford GT40. This was a car that made history by dominating the 24 hours of Le Mans in the 1960s. The GT40s scored four consecutive wins from 1966 to 1969, and it's remembered as one of the greatest racing cars of all time. So when I first looked at this listing, I thought immediately of a Matchbox car. It's quite iconic. So if we fast forward to the early 2000s, Ford decided to revive the GT40's legacy with a modern interpretation. And the result was this 2005 Ford GT. It's a supercar that's captured the essence of the original while incorporating modern day technology and design. The V8 engine launches the GT from 0 to 100 in just over 3.5 seconds, and the top speed's around 320 per hour. If you're interested in this car and you have a spare $800,000, or even if you don't, you can check it out on Trade Me.
That was Jess Malcolm from Trade Me.
Like sands through the hourglass, so are the days of our lives.
It's the day of our life, we call the 17th of April. Ready, Mr. Music? Thank you. This is a song called This Is England by The Clash. Always loved this one. Always loved this one. Anyway, on this day in 1983, Joe Strummer of The Clash ran the London Marathon. Way to go, Joe. He finished in a time of 4 hours and 13 minutes, and he said, my training was drinking 10 pints the night before. All right, there you go. Let's have a look at birthdays on this day. Victoria Beckham turns 50. Jennifer Garner is 52. Couple of Kiwi sportos, Roger Twos is 56, Ian Jones 57, and the actor Sean Bean, who was born Sean Bean but spelt the other way, is 65 years old today. In this day in 1860, the first World Championship boxing match took place, but it was done in an open field in southern England. It was bare knuckle and it was illegal, and they started at 7:29 a.m. precisely in the morning. The two men fought for 2 hours and 27 minutes. They were preparing to come out for the 43rd round when police went, ha-ha, and showed up. And what happened was everyone just scuppered. Off they went. Teachers are coming. And everyone ran away, people fleeing across paddocks up into trees and what have you. The fight was declared a draw. The men were paid $200 each. And as is not surprising, when that's your job, neither fought again. And unfortunately, both died while they were still in their 30s. Yeah. Keeping it somewhat sporty, on this day in 1875, modern snooker was invented by Sir Neville Chamberlain. Not that one, different one. He was a British officer in Jabalpur in India. On this day in 1880, 2,500 people attended the very first, this is in New Zealand, the very first intercity brass band competition at the Christchurch Drill Hall. The winners were the Invercargill Garrison Band, by the way, so there you are. On this day in 1937, my favourite of all of them, Daffy Duck, made his first appearance in Porky's Duck Hunt, of course voiced by Mel Blanc. The Ford Mustang first went on sale on this day in 1964. They sold heaps, 417,000 of them for $2,368. On this day in 1970, Apollo 13 safely returned to Earth. Good old Tom Hanks. On this day in 1982, Afrika Bambaataa and Soul Sonic Force released Planet Rock, the first hip-hop hit with electronic elements and rhythm, powered by a Roland 808. The 808 State Drum Machine, so we'll finish the program with that this morning. And on this day in 2011, Game of Thrones premiered on HBO. And those are just some of the happenings on this day, the 17th of April.
Cash rules everything around me.
With us now from the business team, it's Anna Anzaki. Kia ora, how you doing?
Kia ora, very good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. Now, earlier on we heard about President Trump in court from Bevan Hurley, who's there in New York, and of course he nodded off a bit yesterday. And we were thinking yesterday, we should ask Anand about this. It all opened to great fanfare. I'm selling Trump Social, and it's worth squillions of dollars. It's been on sale. Look at me. I've got all the money in the world. How are the stock prices going with that thing?
Well, okay. It's been a...
That's the best one. That might be the best one-word answer in RNZ history. Okay, tell me.
It's been a rather short honeymoon period for Donald Trump's media company, Trump Media. Great name, of course, Trump Media. Mm. After listing its shares, you will remember on the stock exchange in the US back in March, the company's share price soared when it originally listed, despite Trump Media not really making much money. Revenue last year was about $4 million US. Mm. And no one could really explain why shares were doing so well. But look, reality seems to have hit Trump Media, and its share prices not going so well now. It's it's been a particularly rough few days for Trump Media on Wall Street. Last week, the company saw a 21% drop in its share price. On Monday, when trading resumed this week, shares fell 18%. And this morning, I was looking a short time just before, shares were down 14% again. And it's lost more than $7 billion in market value since its peak shortly after listing in March. What is happening? Well, on Monday, the company revealed plans for future sale of millions of shares. And typically when companies issue more shares, there's always a risk of share prices coming down, partly due to supply and demand. You know, when there's more available, unless there's strong demand, share prices could come down. There's always that risk. Hmm. And this seems to have happened in this case. And so far, US media, they are reporting that Donald Trump's supporters are making up a big part of the investor base. The CEO was praising supporters earlier this month on Fox Business. But on paper, this has not been good for the former president. When shares began trading, the former president's 57% ownership stake was worth more than $6 billion US. Now it's worth about $2 billion, so a paper loss of about $4 billion, which will hurt his net worth. Mm. But look, despite all this, and this is the crazy part, the company is pressing ahead with new plans. They've just announced their plan to launch a streaming platform for content at risk of cancellation. So the roller coaster continues.
Well, there we are. The word worth doing a lot of heavy lifting in that, isn't it? And a lot of those times. This is worth $8 billion. Is it worth it? Is it? There we go. Hey, Anand, thank you so much for that, sir. You can hear more from the business team on Morning Report this morning at 10 to 7. It's 25 to 6. Let's take a look at your midweek money markets now. You can get for your New Zealand dollar 58.82 US cents, 91.81 Australian cents, 47.33 British pence, 55.36 euro cents, 90.91 Japanese yen, and 4.27 yuan. Sports reporter Joe Porter, manning the RNZ sports desk with us this morning. Kia ora, Joe, how you doing?
Good, thank you. Yourself?
I'm good. Now, there are sporting things to go with, but whenever I see the name Booney, I always just want to instantly head to Booney. A guy named David Boone has bought the last test shirt worn by the other David Boone. That's brilliant.
Yeah, how good is this? Ben Strang, one of our journalists, and he works for Morning Report here at RNZ, has uncovered the story. Fantastic. So, yeah, David Boone, who won the Seddon Cricket Club raffle, isn't the 107 test batter known for his moustache and rather prolific drinking ability. He is, in fact, the David Boone, who was born in Tauranga and now resides in England. He's a 63-year-old, and he Seddon Cricket Club, David Boone, they managed to get the cricketer David Boone himself to come along as a guest speaker at their gala dinner last November, and they were raising funds for Northern Districts Junior Cricket. And of course, he put his last ever worn test jersey up for auction. Now, the person that won the initial auction actually never showed up to collect the prize, so the Seddon Cricket Club ended up raffling it off, and it went to who other but David Boone from Tauranga, which is absolutely fantastic. So now David Boone from Tauranga, who actually resides in England, gets to wear David Boone's last ever test jersey. It's fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah, you've got to grow the moustache to go with it. Let's move inside the big rectangle, though. So Geordie Barrett is going to head off and be Irish, and Ian Foster has got himself a gig.
Yeah, that's right. Ian Foster in Japan. We all thought he probably would land in Japan. It made the most sense, especially with his good mate Sir Steve Hansen being director of rugby at the club that he's ended up at. So, yeah, he heads over to Toyota Verblitz for next season. He's going to be their head coach. Steve Hansen is their director of rugby. It's his first permanent role for Ian Foster since the World Cup. It seems like a long time ago and not too long ago at all. Both on the same side. So they've actually signed, which is probably more exciting for most people than Ian Foster signing as coach, they signed Kiwis and Roosters fullback Joey Manu on a deal worth reportedly about $1 million a season. So that's a massive coup for them. He is a big name in rugby league and a big name in sport in general. So that will be interesting to see how Joey goes. And of course, halfback Aaron Smith, former All Black halfback Aaron Smith, he signed a long-term deal with Toyota last season. So he'll be there as well. So a fair few Kiwis that he's linking up with.
Peter Steph de Toys up there. Very good young number eight by the name of Isaiah Mapasua too, everybody. Good young fellow there from Scots and Kings. Good friend. He's my friend Steph.
And, and you'll be pleased to know that David Boone is from your part of the world. He grew up in Tauranga, but he actually went to Napier Boys High.
So there we go. See, he's a good man. There he is too. What else is happening midweek sports wise, mate? Anything else grabbed your fancy?
Well, to be fair, it's really waiting for another big weekend, to be perfectly frank. We've got the Phoenix, of course, coming up, which I think is a huge game this weekend. It's, could be their chance to wrap up that minor premiership or at least go close. It's probably the biggest game in their history. But we've been saying that every week for the last few weeks. But there you go. Hopefully they get a massive crowd along. It really is a bit of a holding pattern at the moment. The Black Caps play their first T20 against Pakistan. They're over there for a five-match series. They start that on Friday. The ANZ Netball Premiership finished on Monday night for their first round. The Warriors team has been named. They've named an unchanged starting lineup from their 22-all Golden Point draw, which was a bit of a lucky escape against Manly to go. So that's a good consistent. No more major injuries for them, although Jas Tavanga has a slight hamstring strain, so he's out off the bench this week. But other than that, there's a fair amount going on into the international world. The international governing body of cycling is very upset with World Athletics for offering the gold medalists this $80,000 prize play for the goldies. So they've said, it goes against the Olympic spirit and the spirit of the Olympic foundations. All the federations were caught off guard. I'm not sure why cycling's particularly upset by it, to be fair, but there you go. They've made making some noise. It's going to be another great weekend of sport, that's for sure. And it's the Warriors looking at an unchanged lineup. It's going to be a good game, I think.
Beautiful. Thank you very much, Joe Porter, on the RNZ Sports Desk for this morning. And of course, RNZ Sport keeps you updated right across the day. 19-6, we'll call it. Nathan Rarere here at First Up Tuatahi Ki Te Oho on RNZ National. Now, it's still to come. News Hub will stay alive in some form with the help from staff, but what's going to happen to their valuable library? We're going to hear from Ngā Taonga Sound and Vision to find out what they want to do with it. And we catch up with trampoline gymnast Dylan Schmidt as he gets ready for Paris. This place gets professional after 6 with morning reports. Corin Dan standing by to tell me what's happening today. How you going?
Very well, thank you, Nathan. I'll tell you about a professional story.
What's it?
David Boone.
Yeah.
The cricketer from Australia who won a raffle for David Boone's last Australian cricket shirt.
That's right, mate. Booney.
Booney. No, great little story from Ben Strang. Just a cute story, really, about a David Boone, a different David Boone, randomly winning a shirt from David Boone. Yeah. And there's more to it than that, too. That's something to look forward to. But we've got some pretty big stories to cover this morning. Obviously, the News Hub stuff announcements. We will talk to Stuff's boss, Sinead Boucher, about that, as well as commentators as well, to see how they're going to pull that off. We've got inflation figures out today. They will be keenly watched by many. They're a bit of a, I guess, an insight in, as to whether we're likely to see interest rates come down anytime soon or when the timing of that might be. So we're expecting annual inflation maybe to track down to 4.2, but maybe 4% if we're lucky. Mm-hmm. And more on the public sector jobs cuts. Phil Pennington's been looking at that the consultant spend on contractors at the police and NZTA, which actually rose. This was last year. So he's been diving into those figures.
All right. Well, that's good. He's done the diving, so we can see what he's got.
That's right. He's very good at it.
Thank you very much. There we are. Corin and Ingrid bringing you morning report after six. Well, 6:45 right here at First Up. Warner Brothers Discovery has done a deal with Stuff to provide news to replace the News Hub bulletins on the TV channel 3. So starting July the 6th, the deal will see Stuff keep a one-hour-long news bulletin each weeknight on 3, and a half-hour bulletin on weekends. Stuff will also keep the News Hub website going. In a media conference yesterday, both parties said they're still ironing out the details, but it's clear that not all the News Hub jobs will be saved. But what will happen to the decades of video footage in News Hub's library? Well, Stuff CEO Sinead Boucher and Warner Brothers Discovery boss Glenn Kine say that preserving the archive is a priority, but the specifics are yet to be worked through.
Yeah, it's probably one of the biggest questions, obviously, that we sought. We received feedback during our internal consultation process with our staff, and our intention, yes, is to preserve the archive, but in terms of how we do that, we're only starting that process now, so in the fullness of time, we'll let people know.
Yeah, I mean, we already have an archive of our own that's 165 years old, so it's really important to, that we both agree that that's protected, that archive is protected, but also that we're able to access and use that, you know, that archival material for ongoing bulletins.
Ngā Taonga Sound and Vision is New Zealand's audiovisual archive. Now, it keeps the country's audiovisual heritage safe and it makes it accessible to the public. Archivists collect and catalogue film reels, videotapes and sound records, and they store them in climate-controlled vaults. They also digitally preserve audiovisual material to keep it for future generations. Ngā Taonga Sound and Vision Chief Executive Honiana Love told our producer Matthew Hutching they've contacted Warner Brothers Discovery to offer to help with the News Hub library.
The News Hub collection is a significant and invaluable record representing, you know, 35 years of news and historic events in Aotearoa. And we have reached out to Warner Brothers Discovery to offer our assistance with the archive. You know, we can see that it would be a significant loss to future generations to not be able to access these unique records and defining moments from our history. As the audiovisual archive for Aotearoa New Zealand, we really do understand the value for New Zealanders of connecting with the material in our care. They can see themselves reflected in our collections and explore them, who they are and where they come from, particularly when you're looking back, you know, both as a young person, but also for those moments where you or your whānau might have featured in our collections. Being able to reconnect with that is incredibly important. It also will tell a continuum of those stories that you see reflected in other archival institutions. So these provide a permanent record of our social history, our interpersonal connections, and our whakapapa.
Tell me about, there are some challenges with storage, aren't there?
Yeah, there's major storage issues with both analogue and digital collections. Of course, analogue collections need to be stored in specialist storage facilities where you manage temperature and humidity. Also, the preservation method that we use is to digitally preserve all of our analogue items to make them both accessible but also the longevity of digital. Then there's managing digital itself. You know, you've got to make sure you've got adequate digital storage, you've got hardware to update, you've got system software, you've got technology that's going obsolete all the time. We store our digital collection big magnetic media tapes, and those need to be constantly updated so we don't end up in the same situation as what we are now, where we have these large collections of magnetic media that is, we no longer have the machines to play. I mean, people who will find videotapes sitting around in their house and no longer have a video player. All of those sort of challenges are ones that we're facing. And, you know, from my understanding of what might be in the collection, we've got a short time to save all this material as well. But we do have the technology to do that. And, you know, we've got a big digital preservation project going on at the moment, which is allowing us to make sure that we can save as much of that material, and particularly our large broadcast collections, including TVNZ and RNZ collections.
That was Ngā Taonga Sound and Vision Chief Executive Honeyana Love talking about the News Hub and 3 News Library. Flying high above the world is Dylan Schmidt, trampoline man on his way to the Olympics. Kia ora, Dylan.
Kia ora, how's it going?
Good, man. How does it feel to have made it again?
Yeah, it's good. Look, it's a bit of a process, you know, and knowing that, you know, it's well in your grasp, but you still got to get the job done and train hard and do it. So, yeah, it's been a bit of a, you know, stint over the last, I guess, 18 months or so qualifying and having some good results last year. And but have the one, I guess, in Cottbus in Germany sort of go well and go my way and finish on a high note and pretty much lock it in as, yeah, feels good.
Oh, that's cool. When do you head to Paris for the Games?
Good question. I think end of June we're heading away. Bit of a competition in Portugal, prepping into it, and then a bit of training in the UK, and then going to the Games. Basically, we're allowed in the village, and I compete on the 2nd of August. So,
I was having a look at the Games program. Yeah, it says all the trampolining done on the 2nd of August. That's just one day. Is that usual?
Yeah, it's usual for the Olympics. The Olympics is a very unusual competition for us because there's only 16 of us, so it's all over pretty quick. Yeah, obviously, usually we have like 3 days of competition sort of spread out, but at the Olympics, it's just bang, bang, bang. Oh. So, yeah, it's definitely a bit weird, but I've done it twice now, so I know it's going to happen, and you just got to kind of prepare for it as best you can.
Yeah, well, that would be good, right, to know about that different format there as an experienced Olympian. So can you tell me, how long does it take them to set it up for you, and when do you get a chance to see the tramps and actually have a go in them just to see if your routine is okay?
Yeah, so the day before, they'll set up the tramps, and I believe, like, usually. Like, obviously, it depends, but usually the day before, because they have to take down, well, they set it up where the gym floor is.
Yeah.
So tramps go in. Sometimes they actually take them down, and then they'll have a competition in the morning, then they'll set them back up, and then we jump on them in the evening. But generally, the people that are doing that are pretty onto it, so Tokyo didn't have any issues with that. So, yeah, we usually get one training on it at the Olympics, which, depending on the competition, you know, we tend to like to have two, but is what it is. So sometimes, like this year, we've had a couple of competitions where they've only let us jump on the tramps once, so you just got to get used to these things and roll with the punches.
Do you have, say, a few routines in mind that you can go to depending on how the tramp feels?
Yeah, there is. Yeah, okay. I mean, obviously there's the one that I'm pretty set on doing that I know is going to give me a good chance, but, you know, if things aren't going well or whatever, I can definitely drop into another routine, which isn't ideal, but it's always there as a backup. But, you know, you're always going for the big one to try and get that one done.
Yeah. You medaled in Tokyo, World Champ 2022. I'm just wondering, let's go back to Tokyo. Since then, how have tricks and routines evolved between then and now?
Yeah, look, I think everyone's jumping pretty high. The routine's definitely up there and definitely a bit more difficult than in Tokyo. There's been a bit of a step up in the athletes, especially, lo and behold, from countries like Russia and Belarus, who haven't been competing internationally for the last little while, but have come back in the nick of time, and well, the Belarusians have guaranteed their spot. So it's definitely tough. I'm one of the older athletes now, so there's a lot of young guns coming through with that are pretty incredible athletes. So, yeah, the routines are big, the scores are big, so basically you just got to go big or go home. It's kind of the mindset.
Yeah. As I mentioned before, experienced Olympian, you know about life there. What are the non-trampoline things that you're most looking forward to about the Olympics?
Honestly, I'm just looking forward to an Olympics without a mask.
True.
Yeah, like just being able to, I guess, socialise, hang out, even with the team, you know, just be more involved in the Games experience. Rio was an amazing experience, but I was only 19 and I think I was a bit starstruck and yeah. I remember most of it, but at the same time, I think I was pretty shy and didn't really take full advantage of everything. So, yeah, Paris, I mean, it's shaping up to be an amazing Games. It looks incredible. It's going to be cool. You know, there's a lot of my mates are sort of living around Europe and traveling and stuff like that, and they'll be doing the whole Euro summer thing. So I should be able to, you know, catch up with them around the Games afterwards and And just having my family there, my mum and dad there again, will be pretty cool. Just having people in the crowd, honestly, will be nice.
Oh, fantastic. I know from talking to some of the swimmers over the years, they've said one of the fun things to do in the village is to go and sit in the cafeteria and look at all the different shapes and sizes of athlete walking past and try and guess, you know, what sport they do. You know, it was quite a cool one. I'm just thinking, as you mentioned there with the socialising, do people do things like swap tracksuits and things like that as souvenirs?
Yeah, I think so. That happens a little bit. Yeah, probably more so within the sports, you know, the people you already know. So, yeah, I know the guys quite well that are going to be going and get along with them pretty well. So, yeah, it'd be cool to just be able to do stuff like that as well.
Now, the first up audience we like to be knowledgeable. So it'd be really great if you could teach us some trampoline jargon or lingo we can add to our repertoire.
Terrible at teaching this.
Yeah. What are some of the trick names that we should know as basics?
Well, a lot of the guys will be starting with a Rudyard Trift Pike. I'm sort of working on that as my third skill, so trying to up the DD a little bit. So my first skill is a full front half pike, half drift pike, and then I do Rudyard Trift Pike at three, so... A lot of people finish, most people finish with a Miller, but the bigger guys, some of them will finish with a Miller Plus. That's probably the two staples I reckon that you want to learn.
Do that one, a Rudy Ultra Pike. And
Rudy Ultra, yep.
Yeah, and a Miller.
Triple front pike with a 2.5 twist or something, I don't know. I don't know. I get a bit confused if I think about it too much. I just like to get up there and do it.
You actually mentioned the big dogs. We're animal lovers here at First Up. Tell us about your dog, Tucko, who I believe you love training Tucko, like to do flips.
Oh, yeah, and no, I trained him to jump on the trampoline, and now I've got a brand new trampoline, and I kind of regret training him to do that. he's a good dog. I trained him for hunting. Actually just went out on the weekend, just cool, first hunt since I've been back, because it's the roar at the moment. So, and we shot a stag together, which is pretty exciting. He loves it. And yeah, it's good fun. But yeah, he's a good boy. So yeah, it's nice having him around. I miss him when I'm away for the months that I'm overseas.
Well,
for sure.
You've just opened the door to having TV cameras come to your folks' houses in New Zealand to film Tucko barking at the TV to watch Dad.
Yeah.
Hey, Dylan, congratulations, mate. It's a real pleasure to get to chat to you. Congratulations on being an Olympian again, and we look forward to your success.
Awesome. Appreciate it.
There he is, Dylan Schmidt. Best in the world, everybody. So, yeah, the Olympics not far away, and it's quite exciting to hear from these young athletes who have worked their whole lives to get to these moments, and they will get to do so. Earlier on in the program, we mentioned that it was on this day in 1983 that Joe Strummer of The Clash ran the London Marathon in a time of 4 hours and 13 minutes. It's impressive finishing that thing. 4:13 is pretty good. Mike's written in, The Clash put on one heck of a show and Christchurch Town Hall in February 1982. Joe Strummer spit into the crowd in response to someone allegedly spitting on him. Something wet landed on my forehead. It was probably sweat, but I like to believe I was spit on by a music legend. That's Mike in Ahuriri. It's like when I was a little kid and we went to watch Hawks play pro rugby, and one of my All Black heroes got sinbinned when they used to stand behind the post, and we were all yelling his name out, and we were all the kids, and he turned around and gave us the fingers, and we were like, yes, he noticed me, yes. It was a great moment in our lives. It could have been that or an autograph, but that was just deemed so much cooler by us. And Jane in Ponsonby, I understand she's got frustration here about Donald Trump coverage, going he's not a good man, what have you, but look, it's news, and it's big news, and we have to cover all of the news here on First Up. We try our best to cover all the best we can. But thank you very much, Jane. I appreciate your message in. Morning Report next with Ingrid and Corin. This song is, of course, the magnificent Planet Rock, released on this day in 1982. It was made on a Roland 808 drum machine, and it went quite big for them. A couple of Kraftwerk samples in there, and one from... Oh, what's that sound called? I think it's Mexico's here. Here we are. We'll take us out. And Morning Report is next. We will download the podcast and take us with you. Oh, we're back in your ears. Up, up, up.